to what end do we want to use mindfulness? And let people use mindfulness as a skill in whatever it is they want to be doing, and that's not our business. But what's your purpose for mindfulness? And what's the deep meaning of mindfulness? What's the deep value of mindfulness? To what end? Some people use it to lower their blood pressure. Quite good idea. To be able to be assertive and not shrink when you have something to say that's difficult, and you can actually keep your feet on the ground and be able to speak your truth anyway, even if it's your parents disapproving, you know, and things like that. Like it's strengthening in all kinds of ways. Very, very useful skill. But the teaching the Buddha gave with mindfulness wasn't just mindfulness. Mindfulness is one of the eight preparing steps of the Eightfold Path leading to liberation. The Buddha's basic teaching, the first time he taught anything, once he'd had his own profound awakening and he decided to teach, he was almost not going to teach and was cajoled, according to the myths and legends, by the gods, begged to share this brilliant understanding of how the mind gets us in trouble and how to become out from the influence of this troublesome mind, to go and share it, in spite of that it's pretty radical and it takes some work. So he decided to go and share his understanding with the first few people with whom he'd been practicing. He had five colleagues who were all very rigorous practitioners. So he goes walking off at 200 miles and finds them and starts teaching them. And the first teaching he taught, it's called the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, was the Four Noble Truths. So simple. We have this tendency, this human being with the mind that we have, that's evolved so to protect us and help us survive, with its being jumpy and nervy and ready for trouble and seeking of mates and being able to farm and all the things we can do to survive. Our survival mind causes us distress. We live often with distress, with stress, with anxiety, with insufficiency, unsatisfiedness. We're not content a lot. Number one. Number two, the reason being is that we think we can improve on the situation. We want something other than what is. We think that the next thing, something else, will be an improvement on this. If it's not very nice, we think we can fix it and get it nicer. If it is nice, we think we can keep it and it won't let it go away, so that we'll always be this way. We have a belief that we, our minds, can, by thinking and scheming and chasing and avoiding, improve. It's the wanting of that that causes the distress. They're together. If we aren't wanting to improve the situation, then this situation is enough. We're content. This is how it is. End of story. End of activity. Nothing to be done. If it isn't okay, this moment isn't absolutely okay, we better do something. We want to do something about it. The wanting. They're together. Not satisfied, wanting to improve. One and two. Three, noble truth, is we don't have to do this. We don't have to have the first state of suffering if we stop wanting to always try and improve it. We don't believe that we somehow must be the improver, playing God. We can be content with this situation and we won't struggle. We won't have that state of never quite okay. It doesn't need to be there. It's optional. But to be able to realize freedom from that struggling, we need to train. It can happen, and it does happen, and it happens many moments throughout the day, but we can make it happen all the time. We can really access and sustain that possibility of no more struggling by training. Occasionally, you have the accidental one who spontaneously awakens without training, the lucky Eckhart Tolles and Byron Katies and people. But it's sort of fluky, and it's usually because they're under incredible duress. They don't usually just happily walk along one day and become awakened. Usually it's a lot of heavy conditions forced it. But for the majority of us, we need to train, and there are eight training steps, one of which is mindfulness. Two of them are being able to see the big picture. And I talked about impersonality yesterday, that fourth one, being able to see things in terms of wanting causes distress, not wanting is freedom from distress. It's not about me or mine or this cat or that diamond ring. It's about distress, its cause, and not having it. Being able to see in terms of that every moment. there are three of these eight which are about, these are really important, these are about ethical living, about being virtuous, about being respectful, about being honest, about not harming, about never speaking lies, about not speaking harshly and unkindly, or even gossiping superficially, about working in activities which cause absolutely no harm to any being, about never taking anything that's not yours. How about just putting that one thing into practice? Don't take anything that's not yours. Don't just help yourself to anyone else's anything else. I just think of people like hearing stories of the Native American people who, before ever the white people came along with their different values, honored every being, every creature, every blade of grass, everything was brother and sister, was sacred, was not just taken, was not exploited. Or the San Bushmen stories we hear in the Kalahari, who, you know, were hunted to survive animals. They ate meat, but they tracked them for days with their sleepy dust arrows until they were falling down, and then they asked if they could take them and have their life because they needed their life to survive. No, not just the exploitation that we do. That attitude, that's what the Buddha says, we need this attitude in everything, in every way we relate to all creatures, all beings. This is like three out of eight, three-eighths of awakening, of freedom, is how we relate. Carefully, wisely, ethically, respectfully, kindly. And then three are meditation trainings of the eight. These three are mindfulness, effort in training the mind, effort to gladden the mind and to abandon unhappy, intense, and stressful states of the mind, which is really meditative efforting, care, and concentration, which I'd also talked about yesterday. Those three skills in meditation, those three skills in living wisely and carefully and respectfully and honestly and not breaking laws and breaking vows and imposing our will or exploiting anything, profiting off anyone, deceiving anyone, and then seeing things in terms of the big truths of how they are, being kind, seeing the noble truths in our experience. If we train in all these eight, including mindfulness, the result, increasingly accessible to us, is less and less and less until there is absence of any degree of stress inside us, liberation from all stress. This is the context of mindfulness, as taught by the Buddha. Now, on the way, it will lower your blood pressure. Great. And it will help you not fight with your mother so quickly, you know, and help you keep your hair on when times are difficult. It is got these fantastically spin-off benefits, which we all can appreciate and value. But I want to talk about the way mindfulness is a teaching about liberation. I mean, in the meaning of liberation and why we meditate. Some people meditate to bring their blood pressure down. It's true and fine and good for you, and I hope it helps. And it will help. I'm confident. But it's so much more. Mindfulness belongs to a way bigger. It's a sacred and profoundly effective tool for something more than blood pressure and shooting rats. Well. So some of the qualities, I know you know this, but this is useful to know, some of the sort of the ways what mindfulness is and its kind of manifestations are being present knowingly. The instructions that we, you know, give you in meditation, actually being here and knowing you're here. And there's no mindfulness when you've gone off on your mental trip, wherever you went, off shopping or something, and then the moment that you're present and suddenly you know you're in a room and you're sitting here and it's Sunday afternoon, there's mindfulness present. It's the knowing quality of being present. That's mindfulness. Mindfulness is also, it's quiet. It's the knower, period. It's not the knower and the thinker and the knower and the judge and the knower and the wanter and the knower and the scheming. It's simply the knower. And that's why I often use the example of the biologist in the field who isn't knowing so that, knowing and anything else, but just accumulating information. Oh, that's what's happening. Period. Period. It puts in a period. Information is recognized, period. It's not, and then I love it, well, then that means so-and-so, and then all this whole other thing can happen. It's not a part of an unfolding plot. It's not in the narrative of I-making and the story of my life. It's just seeing what is so and going, that is so, period. So it's a non-adding. We call it bare attention, bare from any extra, putting in the period. It doesn't have preference. It doesn't get reactive. It says, oh, anger is present, or beauty is present. It doesn't not feel and not care, but it doesn't react. It doesn't then have to go into that controlling, playing God thing. It just is able to see it. So it's clear awareness. It's a faculty. We've all got it. What else would I say about it? It's a truth. It's an ability to perceive truly, clearly, just what is. And that's that. It's also got a kind of caring quality to it. It isn't cold, you know, just plain factual, kind of meaningless. It's got a quality, it's from citta, which is the word meaning the heart, the part of our mind which cares, which holds. Lovely description of the two parts of the mind that I've read recently. This is just an example, it's clever. There is the probing kind of mind that collects information, the mind that documents data, makes sense of things. We have this mind very well developed, particularly in the West. And the example is, it describes that as fingers, the fingers which can probe and collect information. But it's called manas, M-A-N-A-S, that part of the brain, the left part of the brain, data collection, data sorting, facts, fact finding. Then there's the palm of the hand, the palm of the hand that holds, that receives, that cares, that's tender. That's citta, that's the heart of the hand, the heart of the mind. The fingers of the mind are the collecting, busy, manipulative. But the palm isn't busy, doesn't probe and poke, but it holds. Fingers without palms, they can poke around, but they can't actually receive and then gather in and understand. Palms can't explore and get together details. They need those fingers to get the details. But together, we have both the left brain collecting information and the right brain feeling into it, absorbing it, understanding it, holding it. It's an interesting way of describing this part of the mind. Well, citta is that heart part of the mind, the palm. Mindfulness is that part of the mind working. Not the facts. So it isn't just the coolness of facts, it's got the warmness of feeling it. So those are some of the characteristics of mindfulness. And the Buddha taught training in this mindfulness. Now before I go any further, I want to say that, and I think we should always say this at the beginning of Dharma talks, and those of us who've heard numbers of Dharma talks learn that there's lots of stuff said in Dharma talks, all these words. Partly it's entertaining, partly it's informative, partly it's inspiring. And I, for myself, and I know it's true of lots of people, when I listen to Dharma talks, when I trust them, some part of my mind relaxes and I seem to receive them all in the right hemisphere, and I couldn't possibly tell you afterwards what on earth they said. Like, it's not like it's I can kind of collect all that information. So I want to encourage you not to try and retain all the information that I'm giving you, but understand the message of it. And some of your minds will remember certain things, and sometimes you'll hear them, you know, 100 times, and then one day you'll go like, oh, that's what they've been talking about, you know, and it makes sense now. Don't take this as a lecture that you have to get all this or write it all down or something. Just let me offer this to you, because I'm going to say some information that some of you will have no idea what I'm talking about. And that's fine, because some of you will have heard some of these things, and it may be the 100th time, and it may be time for you to put some of this in perspective. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about the 4 foundations of mindfulness the Buddha taught. Because he didn't just teach mindfulness, he taught 4 foundations of it. And in fact, the 4 foundations of mindfulness taught by the Buddha is the most in-depth meditation instruction of all the teachings he gave over 45 years.
And it's incredibly brilliant and incredibly effective for training.
So, some of the ways he taught these four foundations, and I'm going to make them, you know, short and to the point, because it's a fantastic topic. Four. First one, and this is the lists, and I love these lists because my mind is lacks being organized. First is to be mindful of the body. What have I been teaching you all day about walking meditation? To be embodied and know that you are a body and that your body is moving, and its postures and its tensions, and you know the way it is in the middle of a conversation, whether it's shrinking or whether it's pushing or whether it's expanded feeling and all of that. The body, awareness of the body, walking, sitting, lying down, and so on. Second is awareness of, this gets so fascinating, awareness of whether any experience you're having in any moment is pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. The quality, the feeling tone. I'm going to come back to all these and expand on them slightly. It's quite amazing. The third one is, what kind of state is your mind in? Are you bored? Are you dull? Are you excited? Are you agitated? Are you all fired up? You know, like a little three-year-old or sort of excited about discovering things? Or, you know, are you depressed? Is your mind jumpy and nervy? Is your mind serene? The state, it's kind of like your mood, the state of your mind. Is your mind hungry for stuff? Is it resisting and shrinking? All of the state that we're in. That's the third area that the Buddha recommended we explore, we bring attention to. And the fourth is the contents of the mind. This means, somewhere I read, somewhere one who said that your thoughts are the children of your mind. Like, we have a mind and it produces its offspring, and its offspring that the mind puts out are thought after thought after thought, thousands and thousands. Somebody said once 75,000 thoughts a day, and most of them are repeats. But anyway, the products of the mind, these ideas, these images, these stories, all the movies, all that activity of the mind. That's the fourth. So, when we don't meditate, anyone who doesn't meditate, who hasn't any training to their mind, mostly spends all of their time and energy in the fourth, telling the story of me. Right? We just have thought after thought and images and memories and plans and ideas, and that's where we spend our energy. And most of us, without meditating, don't even know we have a body. We don't know how it feels. We don't know what it's doing right now. And some people, even when you try and ask them, they have no idea if their feet are on the ground or on the air, or, you know, if they've got socks on or bare feet or anything. A lot of people don't have any awareness of the body without meditating. A lot of us don't have any awareness that whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, this moment. We usually don't even know that we like something or we don't like something. All we know is all these, oh, I've got to go and go shopping, I've got to go and get this thing of me. We don't realize that it's based on the fact that we just experienced something pleasant and now we want it, and now we're scheming to get it. That's actually what's going on. So we miss completely. We think it's really insignificant that whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. I'm going to get into that one a little bit. Thirdly, we don't have really much idea of what my mind is like. We don't know if we're happy or sad or agitated. If it's extreme, we do. But mostly, we're noticing what the mind is doing, what it's thinking. We'll say, oh, that's really scary. I just saw this really scary thing. We don't know. My mind is afraid. And so it's producing thoughts of, oh, monsters. We don't see that. We just know the thought part, right? The fourth area. That's where we spend all of our energy. That's what we know really well. Am I making sense? Do you agree with me? This is what it's like. Okay, so now you take these teachings of the Buddha, these brilliant teachings of the Buddha, and you start bringing mindfulness to the first three and not the fourth, where all of our attention has been going. And these are what the meditation instructions are. There are instructions to be aware of the body, to be aware of pleasant and unpleasant, and to be aware of the state of your mind. One, two, and three. And this is what happens. Fascinating. When you start paying attention to the body, I mean, just the obvious things, you can feel hot, cold, comfortable, uncomfortable. You can feel moving and vibration and
and all these things. But you can start discovering a whole lot about your experience through the body. When people have been traumatized, their body never forgets it. Then they have a similar experience happen or a similar movement that happens from a one. This has been discovered through trauma therapy. I did that Stephen Levine somatic experiencing training. The similar movement happens as happened before, and it's as though you're in the first experience. I had for myself a peculiar time where I realized this was so true. I had a bad car crash many years ago now. And it was really severe. My car just went right into another car. And in the process, I shattered my left side of my pelvis and dislocated my leg. And I had other smaller injuries. But it was really, really painful. And I was really laid up for a long time. It was almost a year before I didn't have canes anymore and so on. And it was a severe... The car burned up in 4 minutes. And it was really quite dramatic. Horribly painful. And I have two people. One was a really dear friend, and the other was a massage therapist who was trained by her. And they're both very intuitive, energetic healers. And my friend was able to see that my body was still receiving the impact fairly soon after the accident, maybe a month later. And so she put my leg in the position it had been in when it had the impact, which is what it was wanting to do. And it put me back in the accident. And there I was, back in my experience, in this excruciating pain in this accident. But I actually wasn't in the accident now, and I was a meditator. And I could release all the tension in my body deliberately, keep breathing, be mindful, you know, like just know that I was here and that I was present and that she was holding my leg and I was lying on my back and I was in her room, and that I wasn't, in fact, in this accident, even though all my system felt that it was. And I could rerun my response to that. She did that 3 times, and then she had also taught this massage therapist, who's my regular massage therapist, who could do the same thing. It took 4 of those before my body wasn't acting like it was in its accident shape. And it released that trauma from my whole system because I could do that. Like, that's just an example of how the body holds your memory. The body knows. The body doesn't lie. And if through meditation we start to be in touch with our body, we might say, oh, I'm feeling fine, but my jaws are clamped together and I'm frowning. It's like my body is not fine. And we can get tuned in to discover what's much more true about how we are if we can get to know what's going on in the body. So there's an awful lot of information about reality in our experience that's hidden from us when we are not in touch with the body. So it's a really powerful way to get to know what's happening, really, yourself, your truth, how things really are. There's a woman who's done this TED talk. Some of you will have seen this. It's gone viral on YouTube, and her name is Amy Cuddy. Has anybody seen this? This is worth seeing. She has 14,877,000 views when I last checked. Now, that's viral. And she's a psychologist, a social psychologist, and this is what she says: your body language shapes who you are. This is just about body language, positions. And she's taught this thing called the power pose. If you take a few moments in a position, a certain position, it affects your entire perception of who you are and what's happening. So she did a whole lot of photographs on this. It's just a little quick YouTube clip of people going into a challenging situation, like an interview for a new job, let's say, and being really nervous and anxious and holding their heads and sitting, waiting for their turn, you know, in the exam room, whatever. And then they go into the exam room, and then they're anxious and nervous, and they do whatever they do in their interview. And then those sitting like this, comfortably, la-da-da-da-da, or standing with their legs apart or hands on their hips and pacing around and taking 2 minutes of holding a power pose and going in and being completely confident. And they've actually done, you know, now there's the tests in the brain and what actually is going on all through the entire system, all affected by simply physical posture. Anyway, this has gone viral, and it's another latest thing where all the modern technology can reveal. Yeah? What's the name? Amy Cuddy, Cuddy, power posing. Mm-hmm. Yes. Testosterone levels go up, and cortisol levels go down. Right. Yes. Goes up. Goes down. And if you're the other way around, cortisol, receptive, sensitive, anxious producing, testosterone, powerful, confident. Very interesting. And they are measurable inside the system. So your body chemistry changes just by your physical stance. So if you imagine if you live all day walking around easily and comfortably or holding a lot of tension and anxiety, it's going to be affecting everything inside you. The body isn't just an interesting thing. It's like an integral part of who we are. So the Buddha already knew this and said, get to know it. Channel 2, or second foundation of mindfulness, things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is extraordinarily important here because when you don't notice if something's pleasant or unpleasant, which is most of the time, we have no idea. We're just completely not tuned into that. Its pleasantness, the quality of pleasantness or unpleasantness to whatever degree, is going to rule what happens next. Like, you will react to the unpleasantness of somebody's words. Somebody asked a question this morning, Teresa, you asked that question about, you know, somebody criticizing you or being angry with you. That occurrence, you will be reactive to, of course. But if you're able to see, that's really unpleasant. Suddenly you've backed out of the situation and you realize, oh, that's an unpleasant situation. There's a bit of space. What do I want to do with that? But if you can't back out of it, you don't realize it's unpleasant, and it's unpleasant, and it happens to you, you're going to just react out of fear or anger or something. In fact, the unpleasantness of whatever that thing is going to run the show. That's in charge. Pleasantness or unpleasant runs your life. You need this, you want that, you crave this, you want to feel like that, you want to avoid this, you're scared of that. It's all the pleasant and unpleasant parts of your experience that are running your choices. When you do all the things you do, if you notice that it's because this is pleasant or this is unpleasant, suddenly there's a bit of space and you can decide if you want to actually be proactive about having that delicious mango or not. It's not going to compel you. But we're usually compelled. I think of a bull. I've always thought of this, but I have these funny images that go through my mind. A bull with a ring in its nose, and you can just lead it around by this ring. That's why they put rings in bulls' noses, so you can lead them, because otherwise they're really in charge. And they just have to go where the ring is taking them, because it's in their nose. But these states of pleasantness and unpleasantness are what run us when we don't realize it, which is all the time. Non-meditators, all the time. When they're extremely pleasant or extremely unpleasant, we really get triggered. That's what triggering means. And so we can really see that then. We can't see it when it's more, you know, lower key. And when it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant, when it's sort of neutral, we use that word, we don't even notice things. We only notice the stuff that pleases us or that displeases us. The rest we don't bother with. We just do not bother with. The Buddha called that delusion. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed is the pleasant. We want it. Hatred is the unpleasant. We hate it in whatever way. But the rest, forget it. We do not notice. We do not notice people. We do not notice creatures. We do not notice the weather. We do not notice most of it because it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant for us. But when we're meditators, we don't get caught in wanting because we know the state of needing and wanting is not so pleasant as being content. We don't get so caught in aversion because we actually understand what's going on. That person's having a bad hair day. Reminds me of Carol's mother's story, which I haven't said for a few years because I used to say it so much that I got sick of saying it. So now I haven't said it, so now I'm not sick anymore, so now I'll say it. Carol was a friend of mine some years back. Irish girl, woman, something like the 13th of 13 children, huge family. And her mother was this tiny little Irish woman who would come and visit her in Vancouver, who was visiting her in Vancouver one day and needed to go to the bank to get some money. And so Carol and her mother go to the bank and they're waiting in line. And then it's Carol's mother's turn who goes up to the teller and Carol stays back here. And she's this little old lady, sweet little old lady, talking to the teller, and Carol can't see her mother's face because she's back here, but she sees that the teller's being really mean. And she doesn't like the way the teller's treating her mother, and she can't stand it. And so after some moments, she goes up to be beside her mother to basically fend off this mean teller, just in time to hear her mother lean forward and quietly say in her Irish accent, "Have you ever thought of doing different kind of work, dear?" She wasn't caught in the reactivity to the unpleasantness of the teller. She was wise. She was an older, wise woman, and so she wasn't reactive. But mostly, we don't notice that that's unpleasant. We just get caught in it, right? It's running it. And she didn't run her. She had some space there. With meditation, not just the pleasant is less pleasant or less compelling, let's say. We enjoy it, like your question this morning, Raphael, but it doesn't compel us the same way. We don't have to have another one. We don't mind that it's going to get faded. The flower will fade. It will. It's still beautiful. We don't have to get rid of the mean tellers. We can just have some empathy that they're having a terrible day and they're in the wrong job. And as meditators, when we encounter the neutral things, the things that are not so pleasant and not so unpleasant, we start noticing them. We discover, as meditators, life is so rich and so full of amazing, wonderful things that we mostly didn't even bother with because they weren't that impactful. So the life becomes really rich. And furthermore, we can observe, it's fantastic, we can observe that when we're in the company with and noticing some experience or other that's not particularly pleasant, not particularly unpleasant, the sense of me isn't reacting. I can experience this moment that's neither pleasant nor unpleasant and be completely free of any kind of ego. It's those many, many moments of the neutral experience that don't trigger the ego to want or to resist. We can experience many moments of freedom if we can tune into neutral, which we've before completely ignored because they didn't have any significance for us, we thought. They have huge significance. All day long. If we just spent our entire lives wanting and not wanting, we would be dead before we were five. We'd just be exhausted. Be so stressed. But it's not like that. There's tons of neutral, thank the Lord. And so we can have all of these, you know, all through our day, many moments of ease, of peace, where we're not dissatisfied, having to get and having to get rid of. And in dukkha, dukkha isn't there in those moments of apparently neutral times. I can't believe I get so excited about this boring subject of Vedana. The third channel, the third area of mindfulness the Buddha recommended, mindfulness over your mind, mindfulness of the state of your mind. It's the question here is, this is something that's happening, and how are you with that? Deeply, truly, it's not what happens to you that makes you happy or unhappy. It's how you are with it. Carol's mother was okay with the teller, but most of us, which is why we laugh, would not be okay with the teller. The difference is simply in how we are with it, not in the teller. But we put all of our attention untrained in tellers. And we think that's the deal, and that's what makes us happy. We complain about what's going on, and we get excited about the news of this is happening, and this is happening, and we never say how we are with it. But really and truly, you have two people and you have the same circumstance happening and they have a different experience. It's not because of the circumstance, it's because they have a different take. It's our take that makes our happiness and our unhappiness. But when we're non-meditators, we're busy looking at the stuff and then making these comments about it and missing the fact that we are creating our own happiness or unhappiness based on all of that. We have no... We're so not being able to take responsibility. We blame and complain and chase and envy, and it's irrelevant almost. It's how we respond that's the point. So the third foundation of mindfulness is how is that? And the teacher that I went and spent a few weeks with in Burma, Sayadaw Utejaniya, he focuses his teachings completely in this arena. What spin is your mind putting on whatever your experience is? He does not want to know your experience. People tell him their experience, they report this is happening, and this is happening, and then this happened, and then this happened, and he says, so what? I'm not interested in what happens. I'm interested in how you are with this. That's where you are caught. That's where you'll be free. No one else, nowhere else, nothing else. What spin, what covering, what are you making of that? What are you turning it into, and how are you relating? How are you with your experience? Are you happy with it? Are you spacious around it? Are you tender with it? Are you vulnerable with it? Are you honest with it? Are you shrinking from it? Are you agitated by it? How are you with it? This is a fantastically fascinating area that non-meditators with no training of this, so you can be practicing mindful, you know, soldiering or mindful whatever it is, exercising, mindful Tai Chi, not to put down yoga, Tai Chi, any of these things, but without seeing how you are with them, which you can learn through many of the disciplines that where mindfulness is being applied, but without really focusing on this, you won't see this. Mindfulness of the mind. Chitta nupassana, chitta, the mind, and it's that kind of part of the mind. It's not the probing, you know, information gathering, left brain intellect kind of mind. It's the heart mind which perceives, that mind which feels agitated or tender or vulnerable or sad. And then the fourth area is the mental contents, the actual products of the mind. And when we are not trained, we are there. That's where we spend 99.9% of our awareness. And it's a story after a story after a story, and 99.8% of it's made up. It's not actually even happening. We're just creating a movie there, and oftentimes building many. You've heard the teachings of the Buddha about the second dart. The first dart is what happens, and then the second dart, and there's usually 200 second darts, not just a second dart, are what your mind does with it, all of the stories it turns it into. Okay, so I've got a sore shoulder. And then for the next 10 minutes, I'm scheming. Am I ever going to be able to ski again? And, you know, next year, it's been such a crummy year for snow this year, but next year I was going to do this and buy this. And blah, blah, blah. All of that's worry on top of the fact that there's a sensation in the shoulder joint. Those are all second darts. And that's what goes on in the untrained mind. But with meditation, we see worrying, planning, scheming, agitation, longing, judging. And when we see it, because we've got the ability, as I described yesterday, to actually get close to when it's doing a lot of something or other, chronically or strongly or frequently, we can see not just what it does, but how that feels. We can feel stress. We can feel tired. We can feel compressed. We can feel burdened by all this endless worrying. It's worrisome. It's heavy. If you're worrying, there's more than just thoughts. There's the whole body. There's the whole posture. There's the whole gritting of the teeth, all the tensions around, all of the physical stuff. The emotional stuff. There's all more to it. You can actually see all the component pieces going on. When that happens, because we're meditators, we're able to and see what's going on inside like this, the thoughts themselves are less significant. So you're having some thoughts, you recognize I'm having a bunch of worried thoughts. Awareness isn't thoughts. Awareness is back behind that production of thoughts, and it sees thoughts. When it recognizes worrisome thoughts, very often they just stop. They keep going when you don't see them, when you're in your narrative, you're in your drama. But in the moment you become mindful and you're back on your couch or back in the audience, that whole little scenario just goes poof, or it just winds itself down pretty quickly. It's not that big a deal. You're not caught in your believing, thinking, storytelling mind. You're back here in your backing up place of mindfulness, and you see worrisome thoughts. Oh, where did the worrisome thoughts go? They've just gone. Now I've got hungry thoughts. Now I want lunch. When's she going to ring the bell? Oh, now there's a thought of an itch. Now I actually like that person beside me. I'm glad they're sitting here meditating, but I wish that one would stop sniffing. Thoughts, 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 thoughts. And yes, they're just thoughts, and then they're just human thoughts, and then what your mind does, it produces thoughts. And suddenly you're not believing it, loving this neighbor and hating that neighbor, and, you know, longing for the end of the sit, you're back here observing all this stuff going by. And sooner or later you begin to see these are hindrance thoughts that keep me from being okay, and these are awakening kind of thoughts which help me become serene. These are metaphor thoughts. You start seeing your experience of the mind's products in terms of the way the Buddha described them. The dharmas, the truths of things, instead of you and your story and your life. So you see the activity in the mind, it goes on being active, but you don't identify with it anymore. It doesn't have you. This is what happens when you meditate. So you go on being a person, you go on being stimulated and bombarded by tellers and all the rest of it, mothers and everything, people being mad at you, and you don't have the same experience at all. You don't perceive it the same way, you have empathetic response to things, you have compassion for yourself, you have clear boundaries, you're able to be proactive, you're able to understand that all humans have these minds that are trying to survive, and you're grateful for the ones that are useful, and you abandon the ones that aren't. It's unbelievably how different you can be. So mindfulness is huge. Mindfulness needs to have these other qualities. Mindfulness isn't just mindfulness. If we're mindfulness, but continuously mindful, if we're mindful and we keep on watching and we stay present, and we develop this like persistent mindfulness, this stabilized mindfulness, not just a moment of it, but an accessible way of living, it becomes really strong. It becomes refuge. If we have mindfulness which is caring, empathetic, wants to understand, wants to feel with another, it's compassionate, it's kind, it takes care of us, takes care of each other, takes care of the planet. It's got to have this quality of caring with it. It isn't just keep focusing on and getting good at paying attention to the rat hole. It cares about the rats and it can't keep doing that. It's more than mindfulness. Mindfulness becomes what I call wise mindfulness, right mindfulness, deep mindfulness, spiritual mindfulness, sacred, liberating mindfulness. Mindfulness without these other components isn't going to be liberating. It'll just increase your attention. Your attention will have a finer quality, a more stable, pure quality. Great, that can be really useful, but it can also not be that useful. So it depends why you're being mindful and what you're wanting to put it to use. And these teachings are the highest use of mindfulness and all of these skills. The highest use of effort, the highest use of concentration. You can concentrate and get really, really good at, you know, the Rubik's Cube. It doesn't actually serve a lot. Or you can apply it where it's actually the most useful, which is your inner life, and purify your inner life. And you can purify it and purify it and become so completely pure that you never again fall into one moment of distress. And that's pretty unbelievable. So it's this ultimately incredible tool of mindfulness skill. And how do you want to apply this skill and learn this skill? And it is useful in many ways, not to say it shouldn't be used in all these ways, wonderful ways. But it's way more powerful than many of the ways are using it for. Many of its applications are missing its potential. So let's remember its greatest potential.